Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
All day long, and often into the early hours of the morning, the tramp of feet sounded up and down the stairs outside Ward's cubicle. Built into a narrow alcove in a bend of the staircase between the fourth and fifth floors, its plywood walls flexed and creaked with every footstep like the timbers of a rotting windmill. Over 100 people lived in the top three floors of the old rooming house, and sometimes Ward would lie awake on his narrow bunk until 2 or 3 a.m., mechanically counting the last residents returning from the all-night movies in the stadium half a mile away. Through the window, he could hear giant fragments of the amplified dialogue booming among the rooftops. The stadium was never empty. During the day, the huge four-sided screen was raised on its davit, and athletics meetings or football matches ran continuously. For the people in the houses abutting the stadium, the noise must have been unbearable.
Oh man, I knew this story was about overpopulation, but this story actually unsettled me.
If you'll recall, I mentioned this story on another episode and said I was putting off covering it because it gave me the creeps. Creep, subletting, claustrophobic creeps.
This story that we're discussing today is Millennium by J.G. Ballard. And that's Ballard as in Die Hard.
Yeah, I wrote a note. Ballard as in Die Hard instead of Ballard, which my American dialect wants to say. But
I would have said it that way, too.
Millennium I can't hear without also hearing that awful Robbie Williams song, Millennium, pop into my head. Do you remember that song from the late 90s? Oh, good. Please don't look it up. It heavily sampled the Nancy Sinatra theme for You Only Live Twice in the chorus, which is such a much, much better piece of music. Listen to that one instead.
Yeah, I love it.
Talking about hot pieces of music, today's reader is none other than Eric Peabody of Viking Guitar Productions.
Yeah.
Mixing, mastering, voiceover, and podcast support. It's much like Northern Europe in the 9th century. Viking gets into it all.
You may already heard, Eric just did a full reading of Pikmin's model for Halloween. And you can still watch it on YouTube. We'll link out to it in the show notes. This was part of Eric's gig as the narrator for the Horror Hill podcast.
If listeners don't know, Horror Hill is a multiple-story, horror-themed audio storytelling podcast spun off from Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and its popular YouTube channel. Eric is the star. Mm-hmm. And the stories are the handpicked work of dozens of accomplished independent and previously published contributing authors. So please check out Horror Hill. Thank you, Eric, for reading. Speaking of music and authors, I had to put together some playlists for Halloween a few weeks ago. And you know who just sounds like a weird fiction author? Ray Parker Jr. That just sounds like somebody we should be covering on the show.
It does.
But we're not. We're covering this essential science fiction story from 1962 by J.G. Ballard. He's an author, and he definitely has got nothing to do with music at all.
James Graham Ballard was born in 1930 in Shanghai. But he's an English guy, and he's the English guy who wrote Empire of the Sun, a semi-autobiographical book about his time in occupied China during World War II. He spent 2 years in an internment camp as a child until the war ended. This was made into a movie by Steven Spielberg in 1987 that starred a young Christian Bale.
The Japanese attacked Hong Kong on the same morning as Pearl Harbor, and the subsequent invasion and occupation of China was brutal. Ballard would have seen many of the atrocities of war at a young age, which doubtless impacted his work.
In 1945, after the war, he moved to Plymouth and lived with his grandparents, attending college in Cambridge with the intention of becoming a psychiatrist. He got a short story published in his second year there and decided to drop medicine and pursue writing. He later joined the Royal Air Force and was sent to Canada for training. In Canada, he discovered American science fiction magazines.
Yet another solid, promising young man turned to fancy imaginings by Canada.
If I had a nickel. He left the RAF in 1955 and made his science fiction debut in 1956 with two short stories, Escapement in New Worlds magazine and Prima Belladonna in Science Fantasy magazine. His first published novel was The Wind from Nowhere in 1961.
It seems innocuous, The Wind from Nowhere, but that's actually a pretty frightening title on many levels. But I think that book he wrote over a two-week vacation, The Wind from Nowhere, and he was just trying to get a sale, get a foothold in publishing, later omitted that one from his list of books. So I don't know if he was too proud of that one. Oh. It was his second novel, The Drowned World, that helped establish Ballard in what came to be known as the New Wave movement of science fiction, which is sort of a leap forward in the genre, an expansion of style, experimentation of style, a move toward the literary rather than the pulpy, which most science fiction was, and as we've seen. So that was the beginning of Ballard's success and pioneering in this field.
Unfortunately, Ballard's wife, Mary, got pneumonia and died suddenly in 1964, leaving him to raise their three children on his own.
I'm sure that did very little to improve his pretty bleak worldview.
Yeah. He wrote the novel Crash in the 1970s, which was inspired by an art exhibit about the sexual potential of car crashes. And this was made into the Cronenberg film of the same name in 1996. I remember seeing it in the theater.
You saw the movie in the theater?
I did, yeah, on Santa Monica on 2nd Street at the Lemley.
Oh, it was quite the sensation at the Art House Theater there. Yeah, I was a little shocked when I saw the trailer, I remember, but I thought, all right, this is independent film is supposed to be about this, right? Some transgressive stuff. Yeah. People getting turned on by car wrecks. But you know, Disney just bought the Crash franchise.
What?
This is now, yeah, they're going to release a new Crash movie every year. And then a series for Disney Plus. No, that's not true.
For a second, I almost believed it.
Well, I was real confused when there was that other movie, Crash.
Yes.
That Paul Haggis movie that won all those Oscars. I was like, is that a remake of the one with James Spader that made me feel dirty and sick? It was not.
It wasn't. Ballard is known for his dystopian fiction, which I can see, you know, why. His short story collection, Vermilion Sands, in 1971 is the one that fans just really love. Ballard died in 2009 at the age of 78. Interestingly, I didn't know about this, he influenced a lot of music. Joy Division did two songs based on his work, Atrocity, Exhibition, and Disorder. Miss the Girl by The Creatures, Down in the Park by Gary Newman. These are all based on stories that Ballard did.
Wow.
Chrome Injury by The Church. Drowned World by Madonna?
That's crazy.
Madonna was into this guy?
Because every track you listed, I know.
Yeah.
I've never read this author, but I know every single one of those songs, which is pretty insane. And so I was wrong that he has nothing to do with music.
And supposedly Ballard's story, The Sound Sweep, inspired the Buggles song, Video Killed the Radio Star. Now that is, that's icing on the cake there for me.
Yeah, that's the very first video on MTV and a great song. And of course, his novel, The Dismantling of City Spirits, was the inspiration for the song Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr. So it all comes full circle.
That's not true.
No, that's not true. That's not true at all. Those other ones are true.
But this story, Millennium, was first published in the January 1962 edition of Amazing Stories and later appeared in many, many other collections.
Amazing Stories is one of my least favorite anthology titles, I have to admit, because it doesn't really say what. I mean, you know, has ever anybody been like, Amazing Stories? I don't know. I've always preferred my stories bland and uninteresting. Yeah. Just doesn't communicate a lot.
It doesn't tell you anything. No, no.
Yeah.
Now, the word millennium might mean the second millennium, starting with the year 2001, but 2001 actually begins the third millennium, so I'm not sure what that means exactly.
I think it just sounds good and it gets the concept across quickly. You know that millennium that's approaching? Guess what? There's going to be a lot of people in it. Billions. That's all you need to know. Let's get into the story.
As we heard at the top, our main character is John Ward. He lives in this extremely overpopulated city. His apartment is on a staircase and is only 4.5 square meters. And his is over the standard size, which is 4 square meters. So he's actually, because the way it's shaped, he's got more space than most people would normally get.
But he doesn't. It just means he's got 4 square meters. But at the top, the wall bends out half a meter. And so that's what allows them to measure that amount of room and say that's what it is. 4 square meters would be something like a 6 foot by 6 foot room, maybe a little bit bigger than that. So basically something the size or a little smaller than a typical prison cell. But you wouldn't be able to do anything with that extra 0.5 meter, maybe hang a plant. That opening paragraph, the fact that his home is built into the side of a staircase as well. I mean, you can imagine, I can see that space. Like you can imagine it used to be an alcove for cleaning a window, or maybe there was a bust that was displayed there, some kind of artifact. And the mention of the all-night movies outside that he can hear his neighbors coming home from up and down the staircase, it gives you a sense of the internal really quick. And then also really quickly, obviously there has to be entertainment going on all the time outside, because in the world, people can't stand to be in their living spaces.
No way.
So pretty effectively paints this picture for you.
His best buddy, Rossiter, is very envious of his space, but he's good natured about it. He's not like going to kill him or anything. And he likes to visit because most people's places are so tiny that they have to sit on the bed and talk to each other and then swap places every so often so their neck doesn't get sore from being turned the other way.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's this stuff. It's freaking me out. But Ward's place is big enough that they can sit across from each other. Oh, happy day.
Only a couple of months before, Ward lived with seven other people in a ground floor room. So this room alone, the fact that he has his own space is enviable, even though it's small. Mm-hmm. And then obviously they can face each other, which means that people stop by all the time, which is a downside. But he and Rossiter, like everybody else in this world, are constantly scanning ads and looking for a step up, a better place to live. That's like 80% of their conversation all the time.
I know we've talked about this before on the show, but this again reminds me of these small houses, you know, the fad of economize our space and how much can we cram in here and put a little drawer here and do this over there. And
right.
And people converting their vans into apartments.
I think my paranoia was that they're training you to get used to a space like that. But in general, the idea they sell with those things is actually freedom, where they say you live in a van, you can go anywhere, or the tiny houses that people get are actually on large parcels of land or have a view of some kind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes your tiny house can offer you more privacy maybe than you might have in a neighborhood where the houses can see into each other. But that's obviously not what this is at all. In Ward's old ground floor room, he was kept awake all night by the relentless shuffle of people outside. He talks about having to get in a long line for the bathroom in the morning, every morning. These are tiny houses on top of tiny houses, which is a lifestyle I don't think anybody's aspiring to at this point.
No. Now, outside, there is no room for automobiles on the streets. Only in the dead of night is there any kind of car traffic, but that's still just on the streets. The sidewalks are still full, all hours. There's still always people. We also find out that there are human traffic jams where people get squeezed together and they can't move, and people are injured, and some even die from being trampled. And this made me think of the horrible incident that just happened last Halloween in Seoul, Korea, where 157 people died from just such a human traffic jam.
Just a couple of weeks ago. I only had one experience like that. No, obviously not as bad as what happened in Korea, but
sure.
When I was in my 30s, I was riding the bus north on La Brea in Los Angeles on my way home from a job, and the street was just very suddenly and from all sides completely jammed and overwhelmed by this really large protest, which also converged with another protest that was unrelated, other than they'd both been in the, I mean, it was a different protest. It wasn't like they were fighting with one another, but they combined. It was dark out. The bus wasn't going anywhere for a long time because any side streets it could have gotten off on were filled with people. So I said, all right, screw, I'm not going to sit here all night. I got out and decided to walk home, which would have been an hour and some change. But the minute I was in the throng of people, like, I got completely overwhelmed. I had underestimated how many people were really out there.
Right.
I'd been in concerts, festivals, some street parties, parades where I thought, well, I can navigate my way through this. You might get touched a lot, but I was wrong. I got completely suffocated. You stop being able to move because you're kind of being carried along as you get pressed by people. It took me a really panicked half hour to get clear of that crowd. And I thought, I'm never doing that again. You lose all sense of perspective and control. It's terrible. And it's just the sea of people smells bad, you know, is sweaty. It's just the most uncomfortable experience. And this story was when I was reading about people getting into this locked thing here in the story. Yeah. Oh, man, it just really had a sensory. It was a sensory experience for me.
It was making me
feel panicked. Yeah.
Even not having your experience, I still felt uncomfortable and freaked out by this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this rings true. It does that great science fiction thing where it feels like it could be real. Now, Ward himself, he got caught in one of these locks and he was bruised for weeks afterwards.
It was a lock of 20,000 people and it lasted 48 hours. Oh, my God.
As they talk, Rossiter says that he thinks that they're going to start reducing the size of everybody's rooms. 30 million people are in the city now. For frame of reference, the current New York metropolitan area is 18 million, as opposed to in 1960, which was around 7.7 million.
When Rossiter describes his own dwelling as a room, Ward thinks, well, that's a quaint term. You know, it's a hangover from the days 50 years earlier when people had indeed lived one to a room, sometimes unbelievably. One to an apartment or house. The microfilms and the architecture catalogs at the library showed scenes of museums, concert halls, and other public buildings in what appeared to be everyday settings, often virtually empty. two or three people wandering down an enormous gallery or staircase. Traffic moved freely along the center of streets, and in the quieter districts, sections of sidewalk would be deserted for 50 yards or more.
Yeah.
Just the incredulity at this history really tells you how accustomed to this overpopulation they are. I'm getting tired of myself because having moved from LA, which was the second largest, most populous district, you know, county, it's bigger than just the city in the country, to Madison, which is like the 80th, 80, I'm a little shell-shocked by the amount of space available to me.
It's pretty nice.
I'm showing up to movies a half hour early, you know, every time I find parking, I'm like, zip, bang, that was amazing, guys. You know, nobody cares because they're used to it. But it's just impressive to suddenly have room to
breathe. But that's a good point. I mean, that's kind of the point the story's making, how accustomed you got to that lifestyle being in Los Angeles. And then you come out there and then you're like, whoa, I could just find parking. And everybody goes, of course you could find. Why wouldn't you be able to find parking? That's insane that you were accepting that it's okay to live in a place where you couldn't find parking.
Exactly. Well, I even, you know, I go, we can't do, let's do that on a weekday. We can't do that on a weekend. We'll never be able to get in. And people are like, what are you talking about? Of course you will.
But you accepted that. That's what is kind of the horror of this story, is that people just, this is how things are and we're going to roll with it.
And that, you know, his friend said, I think they're going to lower everything from 4 meters to 3. And he goes, people will never accept that. And his friend's like, well, we didn't think they'd accept 4, did we?
Yeah. It's late and they decide to have some dinner across the way. It takes some navigation to get across the street with the rivers of people going past. They can see that it's really busy and they won't get fed for at least a half an hour. So Rossiter suggests they go someplace else, but Ward points out that there is another place close, but it's upstream, and he doubts they'll even be able to get there tonight. Now, we find out the only way to get more room is to get married.
It's double cubicle if you're married and a whole room if you have kids, which is incentivizing population.
They talk about world population, which is said to be 20 billion in the story. But they don't know if they actually believe that those figures. They think maybe they're being fiddled.
Rossiter has an insurance job, so he has some access to census data, but a lot of it is top secret because the government doesn't want to set off mass attacks of claustrophobia.
And in 1960, just for the record, about when this story came out, the world population was 3 billion. The latest UN projections suggest that the world population could grow to around 8.5 billion in 2030, 9.7 billion in 2050, before reaching a peak of around 10.4 billion during the 2080s. Ugh. The population is expected to remain at that level until 2100 and then decline.
Sure. They're trying not to set off mass claustrophobia by saying that, I think. You'd said on our Bicentennial Man coverage that the population may stabilize or decline at some point in the future, which I'm holding on to as something true to help ease my own claustrophobia.
Oh, yeah.
World population has doubled in my lifetime, which obviously isn't proving good for the planet. I was expressing worry on that episode that it would continue exponentially. The official line in this story is that it has plateaued at 20 billion. They don't necessarily believe that, but do you think it will?
I think it will. I watched a whole great documentary on it where they talked about the more modern civilization becomes, the less children they have, and everybody's modernizing slowly and becoming urban. And the more urban that you become, the less useful children are. And being an agrarian society, having lots of children, having a big family is beneficial because they can work the farm and produce more. But contraception's becoming more available. And like countries like Japan and Germany and Scandinavia, the populations are decreasing. Japan drastically so, and they're having problems with their social services because there's not enough young people working to pay for all the old people because they've got a really old, they live a long time in Japan because of the high technology and the good medical care that they have.
Yeah.
But who's paying for that? They're having problems, and they're also fairly xenophobic and they work really hard. So a lot of people from other countries come there and they're like, oh, you're expected to work 60 hours a week or something like that. And people are like, why would I want? No, I don't want to do that. So a lot of foreigners come in and they're just like, nah, this isn't, they don't stay. And so they're not willing to set up.
Man, that's a very well reasoned out reason why that's happening in Japan. I thought that all of the young people were just marrying cartoons. That's what I thought that's what the problem
was. Well, some are. That's, you're not far off base there.
Yeah. Okay, so that is happening a little bit.
That is happening a little bit, yeah.
Okay, I feel less silly now. Okay.
In the story, they've crammed everybody into these cities so that there's more room for agriculture. And in the real world, there are lots of ways around using space for agriculture. From vertical agriculture, you know, that's like where they stack plants up in these structures so they grow up instead of just flat, to harvesting algae for sustenance, which is nutritious, and that's something they can do. There's also a huge market right now for insect protein, which is super easy to grow and there's hardly any waste with it, where they just basically grind up crickets and things into a protein powder that you can use in all types of cooking. And it's super nutritious.
You can grow tons of crickets, or alternatively, you could grow just a few giant insects to eat all the extra people. There are real world solutions either way.
I'm not gross. I would eat bugs. I don't care. I mean, I eat prawns and shrimp, which are basically sea bugs. So, you know, why not?
Grind them up.
So Ward and Rossiter talk on their way to work.
What is really wrong with the population problem, Ward confided to Rossiter, is that no one has ever tried to tackle it. 50 years ago, short-sighted nationalism and industrial expansion put a premium on a rising population curve. And even now, the hidden incentive is to have a large family so that you can gain a little privacy. Single people are penalized simply because there are more of them, and they don't fit neatly into double or triple cubicles. But it's the large family, with its compact, space-saving logistic, that is the real villain. Rossiter nodded, edging nearer the counter, ready to shout his order. Too true. We all look forward to getting married just so that we can have our 6 square meters.
Two young women overhear them talking about this, and one flirts with Rossiter a bit, you know, saying, "Ooh, you sound like the sort of man I ought to get to know."
6 square meters? Go on.
This is Judith and Helen, and they also work with the guys. Now, Judith and Helen tell them that they got kicked out of their old place because they were using the broom closet in the hall as a quiet place to read. She even says, well, you know, it's hard to breathe in there, but it's nice just to have your own little private space. They said since now they've been kicked out, the broom closet has been rented as a room.
Yep.
Oh my God, this story is freaking me out. That's
even
crazy.
The suffering child from Omelas would have had a roommate in this story.
There have been 4 people.
Yeah, there'd be 4 people in there. You're saying broom closet. I don't think it's as fancy as a closet. In the story, they call it a broom cupboard.
Cupboard, yes.
Yeah, Judith and I have been using it as a sort of study hole. Going in there to read, it's quiet and restful if you can get used to not breathing.
Oh God. Oh, I feel it.
Yeah.
When Ward gets back from work to his apartment, he finds out his landlord is kicking him out. He's got more space than he should, and with the new laws coming in, the space is big enough for 2 people. Ward has moved a lot, and he doesn't seem bothered about it. In fact, he kind of laughs it off, seemingly understanding how insane all of this is.
Landlord's like, hey, this place is great. You get easy access to the staircase. It's such a stupid... He can't help but laugh, you know.
Yeah. Now, Ward and Rossiter decide to rent a double in a shabby, shady part of town. The landlord never comes around, and different people are always coming and going. So one night, Rossiter and Ward are talking. Ward is getting so fed up with all this stuff, them losing more and more space, their rights being encroached upon, that he gets, punches the wall, and he makes a hole in it. And then immediately he's like, oh, sorry in there. I just, went nuts. And nobody answers back, which is weird. And then he looks inside and he sees it's an empty room. It's dusty and there are no doors.
As this house was built and rebuilt to accommodate more cubicles, this medium-sized room, I think it's a square space, each wall about 15 feet or 4.5 meters. It got papered and boarded over and just totally forgotten about.
Yes. And nobody's been in there for years. And there is a skylight in the room that illuminates it. And the guys decide they're just going to freaking move in. Keep it secret.
Keep it secret. They have to rig up the panels to keep the landlord from discovering it. They're going to rent the little space they have, and then this is this whole extra room.
And they take turns sitting in it alone at first. They eventually smuggle in some furniture, 2 chairs, a table, and a lamp. They get a mahogany wardrobe, which they had to dismantle to get into the place.
This little step up means so much to them. Eventually, they find the apartment they actually rent, you know, the thing that they actually are paying rent for, too cramped. And so they both sleep in the secret room as well with a divider between them. People are coming and going so much from the structure that, you know, it doesn't get noticed what they're doing there. There's so much turnover. Ward has a back way that he can use to get to the library that's out of traffic. So for a moment, they're in this perfect, less populated world for just a little bit of time in this room, but it can't last for too long.
No. They decide, being good guys, that they should invite Judith and Helen into their spare room.
The 2 girls have been put out yet again from the newer place they got, and it seems like there's plenty of room here for others. So yes, generously, they decide to let them in.
So the 2 girls are ecstatic about it, and they promise to keep mum about the whole thing. They set up a partition in this spare room to give the girls some privacy. As some time passes, things are good, but the girls decide that they're gonna broach the subject. Judith's aunt is this very sweet little old lady, and she needs help.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh God, I see where this is going. But of course, these guys are nice and they say, yeah, there's plenty of room. We got this big space. She can move in with us.
They think at first it seems like they're talking about the partitions because they want more, you know, they're being modest. They want more privacy. But really, they're saying, could we add to this to bring in another person?
So 3 months later, they're still impressed with the size of this room, even with this old lady added in here. You know, Ward says it almost gets larger every day. It's so sad to me.
It's because they have a clean visual field. They talk about how at the end of their beds, they can see space on either side,
yeah,
you know, of the bed and on the wall. I get that.
So eventually they get the room set up with 5 beds in a line with partitions facing this mahogany wardrobe. And they still have open space. You know, the room's big enough that they can line all these beds up on one side of the room, and then they've got a little bit of space there, which is like a dream.
And it's so funny because it's like a nightmare to me when it's all perspective. When I'm watching a movie and they show a big room with lots of cots in it, like I think Day of the Triffids we covered recently, and they had a scene where there was a big room everybody was going to have to sleep in. That's my nightmare, you know, and they love it.
So we come to find out Helen's mother is ill as well, so they decide that she can move in. But then Helen's dad comes along as well. So we find out Ward has quit his job because he's actually making money off these people staying in this space that he's discovered.
Right, but he's home all the time. Mm-hmm. No doubt getting on everybody's nerves. And I think this new man of the house, you know, the father that moved in as well, is getting on his nerves.
Yes.
I think there's 7 people in the space at the end of it. And Mr. Waring is complaining that there are too many people there. I would assume Mr. Waring is that dad. He says there's now 6 people. There's 6 people to a room downstairs in the same size, and we have 7.
The 2 guys,
it's
2 girls,
many.
The aunt.
For a medium-sized room.
For a 15-foot room. I wouldn't even put up with that for just myself.
No.
So trying to make more space, they look at this wardrobe, which has been this great thing, to be able to have this mahogany thing, and realize that it's just gotta go.
The father had also apparently been hinting that Ward should move out, which would be adding insult to injury if there were room.
Ward nodded vaguely and stretched back on his narrow bed, trying not to bang his head on the shelving. Waring was not the first to hint that he move out. Judith's aunt had made a similar suggestion 2 days earlier. Since he had left his job at the library, the small rental he charged the others paid for the little food he needed. He spent most of his time in the room, seeing rather more of the old man than he wanted to, but he had learned to tolerate him. Settling himself, he noticed that the right-hand spire of the wardrobe, all he had been able to see of it for the past 2 months, was now dismantled. It had been a beautiful piece of furniture, in a way symbolizing this whole private world, and the salesman at the store told him there were few like it left. For a moment, Ward felt a sudden pang of regret, as he had done as a child when his father, in a moment of exasperation, had taken something away from him and he had known he would never see it again. Then he pulled himself together. It was a beautiful wardrobe, without doubt. But when it was gone, it would make the room seem even larger.
And that's the end of the story.
The wardrobe is a pretty potent symbol that is, it's something you can keep other things in that you aren't using right then and there. So right. It just really represents space. But then also all of these people are being wardrobed. They're being put in tiny little drawers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Efficiently.
Yeah, it's a great story and really makes me feel things, which a lot of times I don't with these stories because it's sort of an intellectual exercise. But he doesn't get you to just think about them. You feel like what that's like and how unappealing that is. And this perspective of how easy it would be for people to just accept little inconveniences here and there until you're completely inconvenienced. It's such a gradual transformation that you don't notice how much you're losing.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously people are thinking about the housing markets all the time and costs of rent. You know, there was a time when it might, you'd say this should be 10% of your income. I know that people in the city will pay 50%, 60% of their income for where they're living because it's happening to everybody else as well. You know, you just do it or you go along or you accept that reality. And it's so much tougher to buy a house now than it was, say, in the 40s or the 60s written.
Jeez.
And some of that is just they can't make any more land. Mm-hmm. And some of it is just a gradual inflation and acceptance of debt that people take on, you know, that prior to a certain era was unacceptable. You know, I mean, my grandparents They called that on time. Debt, they didn't work credit cards or anything like that. Nobody offering cheap unsecured loans for 25% interest that gets people into trouble. And, you know, there's a lot of things that change in society. And then you just go, well, this is the way it is. And that's what this is about, really, I think.
It's not due to overpopulation, obviously, in our society. It's kind of a consolidation of wealth and power, where wealthy people are getting more and more wealthy, controlling more and more things. And so they're able to raise the prices and then make more money and become more powerful, more money. So on and so forth.
Well, yes. And I think that's why this is an effective story, on top of it's taking one thing and playing it out to a extreme level and really viscerally making you feel it. But the hidden undercurrent of it is, maybe if it's not overpopulation, it'll be something else. You'll just get used to it day over day.
Yeah.
It's inconvenient, but you get used to it.
Oof. Yeah, great story.
And probably this is something that Ballard would have been acquainted with, having lived in an internment camp where you have your whole world is suddenly taken away from you and a living space is assigned to you, right? Which was happening to so many displaced persons during World War II.
Yeah. I want to thank Eric Peabody for being awesome, the man, the mind, the myth behind Viking Guitar.
Yeah, and don't forget to hit up our show notes so you can click on over and see his reading of Pickman's Model, which was really good for Halloween. I know that they just released that for the Cabinet of Curiosities show, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't Pickman's Model one of the
Pickman's Model, yeah.
episodes? I'm being a really bad weird fiction podcaster and I haven't watched any of those
yet. Yeah, it's been middling reviews for the episode. So some folks I know hated it. Some folks thought it was all right. I haven't been chomping at the bit. I did watch Autopsy, which is based on a Michael Shea story, and that one was great.
Well, people really liked The Graveyard Rats, which we covered that Kuttner story as well.
Yeah,
so I think I might jump in on that one. But you can skip the Pickman's Model episode and just go over and listen to Eric's reading of it, and it's probably going to be more delicious.
You're better off, yeah.
You're better off. And of course, that's something that he did in relation to his gig as narrator for the Horror Hill podcast. We'll also link out to that. Please check it out. Thank you, Eric. I also want to thank some patrons.
Me too. I'd like to thank Sass.
Thank you, Sass. I also want to thank Hannibal Oland Alonzo.
I'd like to thank Nicholas Carabine.
Kyle Johnson, thank you so much.
Icaro Saito Nunez, thank you.
Jacob Petrie, thank you.
Robert Conway, thank you so much.
Bjorn Bazin, thank you so much.
Hey, Josh Bell, thank you.
And finally, Frank Gutron, thank you. You guys are the best. We're going to be back next week with The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster, with the Green Dude two-parter on that
two parts.
Legendary science fiction story. I think it's going to be a good one. But for now, that's all we have. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.